From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Once upon a time, a new industry was born in California's countercultural soil. It was to be governed not by profits, but by knowledge, connection, freedom, making the world better, safer, more prosperous, not just for the few, but for the many. Its standard bearer had a crayon-colored logo and the idealistic goal of democratizing information. The company's prime directive? Don't be evil. Obviously, we're talking about Google. Its prime directive is long gone now, and in its place, a world where absolutely everything must be monetized. And in her new book, Don't Be Evil, How Big Tech Betrayed Its Founding Principles and All of Us, Rana Faruhar traces this evolution, or devolution if you want to call it, not just of Google, but of big tech in general, from its idealistic origins to monster monopolies influencing policy, elections, and almost every moment of our lives. So this hour on Point, big tech, our data, and our democracy. And you can join us. Do you feel in control of how big tech shapes your life and uses your data? Should tech companies be regulated more or differently? And how do we encourage innovation and let it flourish and improve the world while also mitigating its downsides? That's a real key question here. Join us. I always have to smile when I say this. Yes, on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, Rana Faruhar joins us today from New York. She's the global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times, also CNN's global economic analyst. And as I said, her new book is Don't Be Evil, How Big Tech Betrayed Its Founding Principles and All of Us. Rana Faruhar, it's great to have you back on Point.
It is so good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I just want folks to know that the epigraph of your book is from Frankenstein. You're kind of showing That's your hand it. Here.
I like to just, you know, get my point of view out there really early.
Okay. So with Mary Shelley as our guiding spirit here, tell me in the earliest pages of your book, you actually sort of bring it right down into the realm of your own life and something that I think many people will recognize. You tell the story of when you had to confiscate your son's digital devices. Tell us about that and why that's sort of central to your examination of big tech.
Yeah, well, that's a great introduction, great setup for me. The power of big tech literally came into my living room one day. I had just started, this was a few years ago, and I had just started my new job as an economic and business columnist for the Financial Times. So I was already thinking a little bit about the topic and just the power financially, politically of big tech. So I come home one day early in my new job and I open my credit card bill and I start looking through and I notice all these small charges in the amounts of, you know, $1.99, $5, something like that. And there's a lot of them. And I think, oh my gosh, I've been hacked.
Yeah.
And then I started to look a little more closely and I noticed all of them were from the App Store. And I thought, oh, I don't buy that much stuff on the App Store. And then I thought, wait a minute, who else has my password? And it was my then 10-year-old son, Alex. So I'm telling truth here. I go downstairs and find him in his usual position after school on the couch with his cell phone out. And it's beeping, you know, and he's intently looking at it. And I say, Alex. And it takes me a minute to get his attention away from the thing, for starters. And then I start quizzing him. And lo and behold, it turns out that he has been playing an online soccer game. And like many of these games, and I'm sure many people relate to this, certainly parents, the apps, the games are given away for free. And I put that free in quotation marks. And you can download it and start playing. But once you start to play and become more and more interested, the game then starts to offer you these sorts of nudges, you know, maybe to buy a cool new player or to put on new soccer shoes. It'll make your guy run faster and get the goal and so on and so forth.
Those dreaded in-app purchases.
In-app purchases, which are huge business. I mean, a game like Fortnite makes almost all of its money from those kinds of things. So, I start to interview Alex, and the more I hear, the more I'm horrified as a mother, but I'm fascinated as a journalist because it was very clear to me that he was not completely in control of his faculties while playing this game, that he was being, you know, decidedly led down this rabbit hole of the game in a very determined way by the app makers. And I thought, I've got to know everything about this. And so I start digging and doing a little research. It turns out there's an entire industry around making, get this, persuasive technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's a field called captology. How Orwellian is that? And, you know, and then I was off to the races and I began to realize just how big this issue is. It's not just about election meddling or monopoly power. This is hitting us in our lizard brains and it's in our kids' hands and it's everywhere.
It's behavior regulation, right?
Indeed, monetization of attention. And so that's really what I discovered is that, you know, we all kind of know when we're online, when we're doing a search, using social media, playing a game, using any app, that we're being tracked. But when you start to look at just how carefully we're being tracked, how much more the algorithms know sometimes about our own desires even than we do, this is a result of what has been going on now for a number of years. It is the monetization of our attention. The business model of that relies on tracking us around surveillance capitalism, mm-hmm. which is what Shoshana Zuboff, who wrote a book of the same title, would call it, turning that into a business model where advertising is sold against what we're doing. And, you know, our very brains, our attention, our desires are kind of weaponized against us, sold back to us. And there's all kinds of other nefarious side effects, which I'm sure we'll get into. But this is the business model of our time. This is a whole new form of capitalism.
Right. So it seems so ubiquitous now, but really, one of the things that I really appreciated about your book is the deep reminders that it didn't have to be this way, right? So take us back to the beginning. I mean, take us back to the Google of the don't be evil era, because I mean, the Google's founders, as you point out, they wrote papers about how, you know, information was supposed to be free. They didn't want to sell advertising, or they were kind of skeptical of advertising. So put us in the Wayback Machine. Oh, my God, the Wayback Machine is like 10 years ago. But
about 20 years ago. 1998 was when, and it seems like it's all gone by in a blink of an eye, which is part and parcel of this kind of highly sped up digital world. Back in 1998, the founders of Google, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, wrote a paper while at Stanford on a search engine, you know, on Google, what would become Google. And they talked about what a search engine would look like. And eventually they talked about how it would be funded. And one of the really, really interesting things in this paper, you have to read to, you know, the very end of it, page 35 or something like that, to get to this part. But they do say very clearly that if you use highly targeted advertising as a way to fund a search engine, you could end up having a search engine that is actually not in the public interest because it could be potentially misused by companies, by public entities. And in fact, they go on to recommend that because of that, it might be better to have, say, an open academic search engine, a nonprofit search engine, you know, something that isn't run as the highly targeted attention monetizing machine that Google is today. And one of the things that's fascinating about this is that it was all there, hiding in plain sight. All you had to do was read. But nobody reads anymore. You know, that's one of the things I've discovered as a financial journalist. Sometimes all you have to do is show up and read the documents because nobody else is, because they're too busy on social media.
So this early idealism, though, that Page and Brin are – they're sort of a couple of the poster children for. I mean, that's important to this story, though, isn't it?
Well, it is. It is. And, you know, these guys, they were very idealistic, like many people in the Valley. I mean, that's what's so tragic. My book tracks this 20-year arc of utopia to dystopia, I would say. And you get a lot of guys, mostly guys, you know, in garages coming up with ways to change the world. Many of them were liberals, but they were also libertarian. And what I mean by that is they had a sense that, you know, the move fast and break things mentality, the look, we're going to do whatever we want. We're going to worry about the larger consequences later. So that was point number one. And I think this is something I come back to again and again in the book. A lot of the engineers that came up with these things that certainly have given us many positive things, but also a lot of negative externalities, they're engineers. They were thinking about how to get from point A to point B to point C. They were not thinking about the fact that, oh, my search engine or my social media website or my app is going to potentially be part of entirely new political regimes or the monetization of violence. They weren't thinking about that. The other thing that happened, and we can come back to this, is that when companies of any kind get closer to IPO, mm-hmm. when they get closer to the payday, to the money day, things change. And that's what happened at Google. They actually, in the beginning, did not want to do highly targeted advertising as a business model. But when they got close to that IPO, they started getting a lot of pressure from their investors.
Oh, Rana, I always appreciate talking to you because you could just basically host yourself here because I was literally just...
I'm so sorry. Just
okay.
Cut me off.
I was literally
a virtual cane.
Just going to ask you that I mean, counterfactual history here. But if Google hadn't decided to go public, would this have ever happened? I mean, I guess you're saying that possibly no.
Well, you know, I wouldn't say that. I would simply say that market pressure,
right.
Be it from an IPO or be it from venture capitalists. I mean, look at companies like WeWork or Uber, which are now kind of blowing up because they have the same move fast, break things, disrupt as much as possible, grab as much market share as possible. Don't worry about making a profit. I mean, the idea is that what's good for business, what's good for profits, is not always in the public interest. And when you have an industry like the technology industry today, which I argue in my book has become really the new too-big-to-fail industry, it is as necessary as electricity, as water. It matters what happens. It's not just about shareholders. It cannot be just about investors. It's got to be about the larger interests of society and stakeholders.
Well, we are talking this hour with Rana Farooqar. Her new book is Don't Be Evil, How Big Tech Betrayed Its Founding Principles and All of Us. And we want to hear from you. How do you think we can get technological progress back to those founding principles and also protect all of us from the downsides of hyperspeed innovation? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Rana Farooqar. She is the global business columnist and an associate editor at the Financial Times, and she's author of the new book, Don't Be Evil, How Big Tech Betrayed Its Founding Principles and All of Us. And we have an excerpt, by the way, of Rana's book at onpointradio.org. So, Rana, I actually want to explore with you a little bit of your own experience in tech, actually, because it's really illustrative. So can you take us back to the previous bubble that we were at and the fact
you're
that
you're going to make me talk about all the embarrassing moments.
I am. I'm here to learn. We're all here to learn.
Thank you for that. Well, so was I. Let me tell you, back in 1999, I was there to learn. I was working at that time in New York as kind of a mid-level magazine journalist at Newsweek magazine. And I had done a big piece on not Silicon Valley, but on Europe's tech boom, which, you know, Europe was going through kind of a similar tech boom to the U.S. back in the late 1990s. And I wrote this, you know, feverish story entitled Europe's Got Net Fever. It was a cover and I got a lot of attention. And one day I'm sitting in my office and I get a call from some investors who want to hire me to work in their high tech incubator in London, which was funded by major investors, Citibank, Whitney, you know, some of the big, important financial institutions. And I was just kind of stunned and amazed and thrilled, right? Because this was the height of the dot-com boom. I could get in on the action. And I thought, all right, you know, this sounds like it could go belly up. You never know. I'd been covering business for a long time. It could be risky, but I'll still know more about tech. So I head over to London to work, if you can believe it, as a venture capitalist, having either no tech or finance experience, which should have told me right there that was a market top. You know, when they're hiring journalists, you know, giving them thousands of stock options when they don't really know that much, you know you're at a market peak, which, P.S., I think we're at again, which we should come back to. But so I go over, and what was interesting to me even then is I could very quickly see that this was an industry in which there were going to be just a handful of winners and lots of losers. So there were certain things that were quite similar in the environment. There had been a loosening of monetary policy. There had been some tax cuts in 1997, which had encouraged a lot of speculation in both the U.S. and Europe. Everybody was hot for dot-coms. I mean, you remember some of these dot-coms, pets.com. Remember that? The blue one?
Barely.
Barely. Yeah. Enron was happening around that time, WorldCom. You know, there was a lot of excitement about the new economy, and I put it in quotation marks, and B2C media deals, if you can imagine that lingo. But there weren't a lot of people who actually were inventing things that were new and had the understanding and the know-how to really build a sustainable market. And so very quickly, about a year after I joined that firm, you started to see the boom turning to bust. And I ended up leaving because, frankly, I was so discouraged by the hype and, you know, seeing it from the inside, knowing how little there really was to sell. We were looking at a lot of copycat properties, a lot of, ill-fated attempts to try and turn legacy brands into dot-com startups. And it was a lot of marketing spin. It really wasn't a lot of innovation. But I did learn something about bubbles. And what I would say is I think we are at a very similar moment. I mean, just look at some of the business headlines of this week. You see SoftBank, which is this mega venture capital firm that invested in Uber and WeWork, coming out with really bad earnings reports, mm-hmm. losing money. I think that years of debt, encouraged by easy money, encouraged by low interest rates, encouraged by a lot of speculation in tech, have resulted in another bubble, and it's probably poised to pop.
Okay. So I want to dig in a little further here on sort of what the foundational forces are for the moment that we find ourselves in. We'll come back to the financial and capitalism side of things here, because that's really important.
Yeah.
But there's also, you just touched on something a little earlier that I think is worth quite a bit of time, and that's quite simply the mindset or mindsets of the people who are creating this technology. Okay. So first of all, I mean, because you said it's not so much liberalism, but libertarianism. And that's a very, very important distinction, right?
It is.
Go ahead.
No, it is. And, you know, I would point to Facebook as just the absolute exemplar of that. I mean, this is a company that professes that its only goal was ever to just connect the world and do wonderful things. But it has knowingly monetized violence. It refuses to police patently false political advertising. Mark Zuckerberg, you know, I was frankly stunned a couple of weeks ago when he got up in the Hill, this latest speech, and gave a speech at Georgetown, likening Facebook to, a protector of free speech a la MLK or Frederick Douglass, you know, evoking
that.
I just thought Mark Zuckerberg can reach
the same heights as Dr. King.
Gee, like those two names should not be in the same sentence. And which, frankly, this also goes to show something. I just am wowed by the PR missteps of this firm. And what this tells me is that they are living in an utter cognitive bubble. But to come back to your point, those two things are not disconnected. Silicon Valley is a bubble. I mean, it is a bubble economy. GDP growth in Silicon Valley itself is about 6%. It's under 2% in the rest of the country. So they really are in a world of their own. And these companies are kind of the apex of the last 40 years of economic thinking, kind of neoliberal economic thinking that says companies can go wherever they want, they can put capital wherever they want. Now they can move data across borders however they want, in whatever opaque way they see fit. They can own all the value from that data, which is the new oil in the economy. And they're floating above national political concerns in a way that I find very, very disturbing.
Okay, so I have to talk to you about this because, you know, when Zuckerberg testified before the House Financial Services Committee, right, about Libra, the cryptocurrency.
Oh, my God. Don't get me started.
But there, my favorite moment from those hearings, if one can have a favorite moment in these things.
No, I love it. I can't wait to hear what it is.
It's one that almost nobody, like, obsessed about except maybe me and a couple of other folks. But there was a moment in which Mark Zuckerberg said that he wanted to launch a cryptocurrency for Facebook because he believed – he just said this very plainly and without blinking. He said – I've got the quote here. He said, it's because I view the financial infrastructure of the United States as outdated. And then he just moved on.
Actually, I am so glad you highlighted that. I remember hearing that, and I kind of – there were so many egregious things in that speech that I quickly moved on to something else. But that's actually a hugely important point because it plays to exactly what I'm saying. The people that run these companies – first of all, they came of age. Think about it. From the 80s onward, that was a time in which governments were kind of considered good for nothing but cutting taxes, right? The government wasn't supposed to be doing anything but getting out of the way. So there's this kind of idea that any stakeholder, the public sector, elected officials, citizens, the sort of demos of society itself is just in the way and that they can push it out and disrupt and innovate, in quotation marks again, in whatever way they see fit, and that they shouldn't have to be subject to regulation. And it's interesting that he talks about the financial industry being outdated. The way in which big tech executives get up in Washington and talk about how special their industry is and how it really can't be looked at like other industries and it just can't be regulated or broken up, very similar to what you heard right around the financial crisis before and after. Here's a newsflash. Neither finance nor technology are special. They are profit-seeking industries, and they need to be subject to the same regulation as any other kind of industry.
So the thing about when people like Mark Zuckerberg say things like that is what puts the chill in my spine is that he's being completely honest in that moment. Like he's like the financial system is outdated. We can do better. We can come up with something better. That's what we do. We move fast and break things, even if on the walls of Facebook headquarters, when you go at corporate headquarters, it says move fast and build things now. It's kind of an internal PR exercise, if you ask me. But you have a quote in your book from venture capitalist Bill Janeway, who told you, quote, "Zuck and many of the rest of the tech titans have an amazing naivete about context. They really believe that because they are inventing the new economy, they can't really learn anything from the old one. The result is that you get these cultural and political frictions that are offsetting many of the benefits of the technology itself." Now, it's one thing, Rana, if — oh my God, I'm going to date myself here — but, you know, kind of a super nerd at Bell Labs, former Bell Labs, is like, hey, let's change stuff. But it's another thing when someone of the wealth and political power and sort of data influence of someone like Mark Zuckerberg says, I want to change the financial system. That is that not what's fundamentally different about the time we're living in now?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's different and it's not different. At core, this is about power. Power has migrated to various places over time. And right now, power lives nowhere as much as it does in Silicon Valley. It is the most powerful economically and politically industry in the country. That's the biggest lobbying force in the country. Zuck and the rest of the tech titans have incredible sway in Washington. It's interesting. You know, you hear them sit up there on the Hill. You think they're being grilled. You think they're under a lot of pressure. We'll see. I mean, we'll see. Maybe if Elizabeth Warren is president and there's a Democratic sweep of Congress and there can be some agreement on the sorts of regulation that we need, we'll see real change. I'm not holding my breath so much yet because these tech companies have bought out so many regulators, academics that study these industries and testify when there are Senate hearings about the topic, both in D.C. and in Brussels. They are very, very powerful, and that's no different than the CEO of a bank or, frankly, the Gilded Era railroad barons, who they resemble quite a lot.
Yeah. Well, okay, so that makes me wonder, Ron. I mean, in the subtitle of your book, it says how big tech betrayed its founding principles, and there's a presumption there that its founding principles were good ones that we should laud. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if we're just imagining something that was never really there to begin with.
It's a great question. I think that there was in the beginning of this industry, you know, even going back so far as the Bell Labs and the really the original Silicon Valley, I think there was kind of a hippie change the world mentality. It always, though, came with this libertarian, this sort of odd flip side of libertarianism, where we want to change the world, but we also want to fight the man. We don't want to be governed by anyone. We don't want to have to be controlled by any kind of outside entity. And you can see a lot of that in the tech titans today. People like Sheryl Sandberg, Mark Zuckerberg, who, by the way, if you think about their users, as individuals, they control more people than China does, you know, than India does, than the largest country in the world in terms of users on their platform. And they float above the problems of different countries. They seem to feel that they're not subject to the regulation of elected officials. So they're supranational. And that's a long way from those hippie roots. And there's always been an uncomfortable friction between those two things, I think.
Well, we are talking this hour with Rana Faruhar. She is global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times. Her new book is Don't Be Evil, How Big Tech Betrayed Its Founding Principles and All of Us. Let's take a quick call. Let's go to Ray, who's calling from Portland, Maine. Ray, you're on the air.
How you doing, Magna?
I'm doing all right. Go ahead, Ray.
Well, I had my original question was more about the election and why they need to be regulated, but I want to go back more to the core central cause or problem or issues of this thing that we're talking about, and it's pretty much capitalism to some extent. And now, this is the reason why I'm going to be voting either for Warren or Bernie. Because as far as I'm concerned, since 2008, and perhaps even before then, I don't really have a lot of faith in the way we've constructed our capitalistic empire here. And unfortunately, I think Zuckerberg and all of those tech titans had some really cool ideas, and mm-hmm. their ideas are cool. And technology is wonderful, you know.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, whenever capitalism comes into contact with any other ism, it has a very corrupting effect on it.
Yeah.
And so you start moving away from whatever your original mission statement was, and then you start being manipulated by capitalistic forces. And so we're starting to see 20 years down the road the result of all that. And that has affected not only our economy, but our politics and our society. And, you know, it's given us a president who can tweet until he's blue in the face. And for whatever reason, he hasn't lost his Twitter account. Whereas if you and I were tweeting like that, forget it.
Hey, Ray, really good point. And let me just turn it back to Rana Faruhar. Yeah. Ray, thank you for your call. Go ahead, Rana.
Yeah, great. No, that's actually, it's a great point. I'm glad that, Ray, that you put it so succinctly. I have two thoughts. One, I kind of agree with you. I guess I would tweak it and say, though, the problem is capitalism the way we've been practicing it. This was actually kind of the topic of my first book, which I won't be, like, egregiously self-promoting to go there. But you know, we think sometimes in America, particularly, that capitalism was handed down on stone tablets, and the kind of laissez-faire, very, very market-oriented kind of capitalism is the only way. Other countries make different decisions. You know, Germany, France, China, you know, all these countries practice different kinds of capitalism. I think that one of the issues is that the last 40 years have led to a kind of capitalism in which, you're right, there's been this incredible asymmetry between the power of corporations and the power of individuals and particularly workers. That problem, which was already apparent, right, in big multinational companies and the asymmetry between labor and capital and the inequality gap that we know has been increasing in the U.S. for over two decades now, that was already apparent before the digital giants grew. But they kind of threw kerosene on that problem because all of the trends, the ability to grow to a huge size and winnow out other competition, the ability to have incredibly sized market caps without actually hiring that many people, the ability to be incredibly opaque. I mean, we don't really know what's going on in the black box of Facebook. We know less about what's going on in Facebook's black box than we do about what's happening in a big global bank. So all those things make it really, really difficult for these companies to enrich the larger ecosystem in the way they should. I do think there are ways to change that. And I would go back again to that founding paper, that 1998 paper by Google. You know, don't be evil. Maybe we need to put some of these things in service to the public and turn them into utilities.
Turn them into utilities. Okay, we'll talk more about that a little later in the show. So Rana Faruhar, hang in there. We're talking about Rana's new book. It's called Don't Be Evil, How Big Tech Betrayed Its Founding Principles and All of Us. We've got some comments coming in on our website. Someone's saying Zuckerberg is not a political philosopher concerned about the public good. There is zero evidence he's a deep thinker of any sort. He's a Harvard boy who stumbled into a good idea and had the necessary connections to get very rich from it. End of story. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Rana Faruhar. She is global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times. She's got a new book out. It's called Don't Be Evil, How Big Tech Betrayed Its Founding Principles and All of Us. We've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Now, Rana, we've been sort of tossing around a lot of the mantras from some pretty famous big tech companies. Don't be evil. Both of us have talked about move fast and break things. There's also always be hustling, one of my least favorite ones.
Oh, God, me
from
too.
Uber. But you got a chance to spend time with former Uber CEO Travis Kalanick, and it's absolutely fascinating. And for those of us, meaning everybody else who's never gotten to have them, to spend time with him, can you tell us what that was like and what he was like? Because, again, it provides some really important insight into sort of the thinking that's shaping Silicon Valley.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's wonderful when, as a journalist, you get a significant amount of time with a character, because if you stick around long enough, no matter how tightly someone's being managed by their PR team, and believe me, he was being managed very tightly, they sort of show themselves and who they are. Travis was somebody that was absolutely a disruptor. I mean, he was very identified with the young, kind of Ivy League educated, will do anything for Facebook, Uber, I should say, will do anything for Uber, you know, totally believing in the mission, much more identified with that group of workers than with the drivers that were actually out there creating the real business model day on day. And there was a very interesting moment where I think the mask really fell. I'd spent quite a lot of time actually in the Boston headquarters with him. And we had met everybody, you know, in the main office and seen all the free snacks and the smiley faces and the shiny talk. And then we went off to a special event that Uber was holding for a group of drivers. And these drivers, mind you, were amongst the top performers. They'd been carefully handpicked, clearly. I was allowed to meet some of them and sit amongst them. And he gave a talk about how much he valued them. But he was very, very careful not to say anything that would qualify them as actual full-time employees. And at the time, Uber was kind of moving towards its IPO, and some questions came up about shares. And the drivers said, well, you know, you say that we're part of this family and that we're part of this ecosystem. You couldn't do without us. Will we be allowed to take part in the IPO and really, you know, participate and have some shares? And he was really stopped up, and there was a lot of hums and stumblings and, well, you know, that's complicated. And it was so interesting because a woman sitting right next to me who was a single mom working her way through school, you know, driving an Uber to make money, said, that's ridiculous. And people started complaining about the no tips policy, which was eventually changed. Well, in the end, Uber did award a certain number of share options to drivers, but they are still battling efforts by unions and politicians to say, how can you count these people not as employees? How can you possibly say, when you are managing them down to the second with algorithmic software, which, by the way, going back to the asymmetry of power, the software that Uber drivers put in their car, it knows everything about them. Uber keeps all that information. It can have them pull them away to jobs that are more convenient for Uber but less convenient for them. I mean, there's always this asymmetry of power. And yet these people receive no benefits, none of the safety net of normal workers. And that's part of the problem of the gig economy. And I think one of the reasons, I'll just say one more thing, that the Uber story so resonates with so many people is it's not just about Uber. It's the Uberization of everything.
Right.
If you think about it, almost all of our jobs could be Uberized in some way. And in fact, I predict that many of them will be.
But on the other hand, you know, Uber's IPO wasn't, you know, the supernova that people had had hoped it to be. And I mean, I'm hearing people to this day say that they think Uber's actual business model is terrible.
Well, and this gets to to call it a Ponzi scheme might be strong, but there is a way, there's something false about the inflating of these unicorns, they call them, you know, companies, Silicon Valley companies that are private with a $1 billion market cap and then go to IPO and everybody expects great things. And then now some of them are collapsing. There was always something false about the idea of go out, break regulations everywhere, build a business no matter what the cost, grab market share, ring fence as much data as you can, mm-hmm. because it's all about the number of users and their personal data and getting that in your network rather than Lyft's or anybody else's. Not worrying about profits, which actually, from a regulatory standpoint, is kind of a monopolistic position. And that's something that's being talked about now. This notion that, well, you go and you sell people on this business model, you're not actually making any profits, but you are killing competition by jumping the queue. They then go public. Investors suddenly want to know, where's the profit? The whole scheme starts to kind of, you know, fray at the edges. And I think that as regulators began to really look at these business models and say, are our antitrust laws even geared up to deal with this? You could see them being pulled apart even further.
So I keep coming back to this idea of, like, what are or what were those fundamental founding principles, and sort of how, if we want to get back to them, what exactly are we trying to get back to here? Because, okay, in Kalanick, you have this, as you said, this example of sort of the great disruptor, right? Really changing how anything moves in cities and towns here. But never in those founding values was this question of, when we disrupt things, who's going to bear the consequences of that, right?
Well, exactly. And I mean, I think that going back to your question that you posed in the last segment, were there really any different founding principles. Well, you got me thinking about that. I would say what was different is that these companies said, don't be evil. They said, we're not going to be evil. I mean, they put that in. That was
one
their mission. One of them did. But that was a kind of an ethos. And interestingly, I think that they bought their own hype and thought, hey, we really are different. We're this kind of Teflon industry. We're connecting the world, and whatever we do will be good. But they didn't think about what are the implications going to be of growing that big, becoming that powerful. And then, you know, once the bankers and the lobbyists and the machine of a large corporation comes in, things start to change. And unfortunately, many of these companies actually still behave at the top like small companies, even though they have tens, if not hundreds of thousands of employees.
So I think the reason why I'm still dwelling in this space, Rana, is because, first of all, like my background is in science and engineering. So the concept of innovation and development and progress, I'm a fan, you know, like
sure.
I'm not
100%.
I'm not a technophobe. I might be definitely a slow adopter, though. But
you're not on a BlackBerry.
No, although every once in a while I think I'm so dubious about the data collection. I think I'm going to move back to semaphores. But here's what I'm getting at, and you're exactly the kind of person I want to run this analogy by. I wonder if this problem, this fundamental problem, has always been with us. Because I keep thinking to myself, look, in the early and middle of 20th century, when scientists said, we want to learn how to split the atom, you know, it was for the sake of the science to understand how the world worked. And yes, later on, through the Manhattan Project, it also became in terms of, you know, developing a weapon of war. And in fact, Einstein himself was one of the people who first alerted FDR and said, you need to learn how to split the atom because the Nazis might beat you to it. And then Einstein later on, of course, expressed deep regret about the cataclysmic power of nuclear weapons.
So,
do you see what I'm saying?
Okay.
I
see what you're saying.
The regret comes later.
Can I turn a question back on you? Because I'm actually fascinated by this. One of the things I keep coming back to in my book and in my research, I really pondered this engineering mindset, right? One of the sources I called upon actually for my book was an earlier book on Google by Ken Oletta, the New Yorker writer. And he very much dug into that engineering mindset. It's wonderful. I mean, my father's an engineer. I come from a family of engineers, you know, and I tend to be very kind of data oriented myself. It's a wonderful mindset, but it can get very siloed and very linear. And there's a kind of, well, we just have to get from point A to point B to point C in the quickest way and the most efficient way. We're not going to think about what's happening in that larger ecosystem, which would be more of a kind of a biology mindset. It's a little messier, mm-hmm. right? It's less engineering, less physics, more, hey, we're in this big ecosystem together. And, you know, what I do is actually affecting you. Or, do you think, is that fair? Is that what you're feeling?
I think that is fair. And sort of the laser-like focus on finding the most elegant and inefficient sort of path towards a goal would describe the engineering mindset. But what I feel like is we're living in a world now where, okay, people probably will disagree with me saying this, if we're not going to hold the individual responsibility amongst those engineers in Silicon Valley, what we really need to do is society, governments need to be far more aggressive in saying we must 100%. Mitigate from the beginning the consequences of this technological development. Can we do that?
That's very interesting. Yeah, yes. And I think we can. And in fact, that's something other countries do. And I get a bit into that. And it's something that's starting to happen here. So if you think about just to kind of look at this economically for a minute, and then I'm going to weave this larger picture. If you think about the fact that according to McKinsey, 80% of corporate value is now living in 10% of companies that have the most data and intellectual property. So the biggest of those are these big tech platform companies and some of the other big tech component companies, Cisco, Intel, Qualcomm, et cetera. But it's basically tech owns that space, and particularly companies that own data own that space. So that, you know, you can't have five companies owning everything in the economy, or the economy kind of stops working. Also, it's not fair to have taxpayer-funded innovation. If you think about how did we get the internet? How do we get GPS? How do we get touchscreen technology? How do we get most of what makes a smartphone smart and fuels these companies? We paid for it. That was basic science research done out of the Department of Defense and DARPA, generally. And in other countries, when that happens, in places like Denmark or Israel, the public sector takes a stake, an equity stake in those companies. And so that's one of the solutions that's being tossed around. There are others, California, which interestingly, I mean, it's breeding place of all this, but also kind of ahead on thinking about fairer ways to divide the pie and regulate these companies. They're talking about a data sovereign wealth fund where data would exist in the public sphere. And these companies that collect it would have some access to it, but so would smaller companies, so would individuals, so would the public. And very important ruling on that front recently, which everybody should know about. In Toronto, Google has a sister company called Sidewalks Labs, and they have been trying to do a what they call a smart city in Toronto, where they would place sensors all over a 12-acre portion of the waterfront. And the idea is to follow individuals, follow the city's traffic patterns, create more efficient, energy-efficient cities, safer cities. Okay, that's all great. But until recently, Google was going to own all that data and be able to do whatever they wanted with it. The same way that Amazon, when they had their bake-off for their second headquarters, got to go in, look at all this city data, own it, get, you know, and the cities get zero in return. And so Toronto, I think because of this conversation that we're having and others are starting to have, actually pushed back a few days ago and said, you know what, no. This is going to live in a public data bank because we need to make sure that not only do taxpayers and citizens own some of this, but other companies can also access it so this doesn't become a winner-take-all game.
Wow. The idea of a data sovereign wealth fund is fascinating, right?
Yeah, and it's not unprecedented because think about it. Alaska and Wyoming have already done successful sovereign wealth funds. Data is the new oil.
Exactly. So we just have a couple minutes left to go, Rana, and I want to ask you, there is something that you bring up in the book, which I found a little disheartening.
Sorry.
Reality
there are many things that are disheartening in this book.
Reality can sometimes do that, but we won't be afraid of it. You suggest that big tech companies might already be too big to fail because of the way the finance works and how they're intertwined into the global economy. Can you explain that?
Yeah. There's a couple of things.
We've just got 2 minutes, by the way.
Okay. Well, they're holding the majority of wealth. Much of it is in offshore bond portfolios. It's a complicated topic, but basically, if these companies were to start, you know, selling off a lot of the corporate bonds that they own, that could trigger a market-moving event. That's just to show you how big they are. But really, a more profound point is that data surveillance is the cat is out of the bag. Now, some people would like to say, look, we need to put a stop to all of this. But China's moving ahead. Emerging markets are moving ahead. How Europe and the U.S. go, it's unclear. It is going to be very, very difficult to reset. But I, honest to God, I think that we need to have a reset. We need to have a big, open, public, democratic conversation about this. Otherwise, I fear that the populism that we have seen is going to be put on steroids by these companies.
But does that mean that you'd be concerned about the consequences if these companies were to be more further regulated or even broken up?
No, I think that if we get on them now, if we have a clear path towards what they're going to look like, that's fine. And in fact, I think that the railroad monopolies of the turn of the century actually provide an interesting construct for that. You shouldn't own a network and all the commerce that goes on it. That is just not fair. You cannot be, owning the rails and the cars and the coal in the cars, you know, and that's essentially what an Amazon or a Google or a Facebook in some senses do today. And I think that that is going to change.
Well, Rana Farooqar is global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times. She's also CNN's global economic analyst. Her new book is Don't Be Evil, How Big Tech Betrayed Its Founding Principles and All of Us. We've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Rana, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for a great interview.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from Sharif Campbell, Celeste Katz-Marston, Jeffrey Line, Wes Martin, and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.